Lord Downing, as you sit here nearly 30 years after the events, that period of 16 weeks that has now been called the Battle of Britain, what memories are uppermost in your mind?
Well, the overriding memory is one of intolerable stress, mingled, of course, with anxiety that so much depended on our shoulders in the fighter command to prevent the country being invaded and vanquished, and partly simply because of the enormous quantity of work that had to be done. Because not only was I engaged in the day-to-day fighting of the time and its results and so on, but also the period of night fighting was just beginning then, and we were in a very promising position to meet the requirements, but one didn't only need to be in a promising position, one had got to strain every effort to expedite the results of the work that I knew was going on. And so I used to spend a good many nights down some miles away at the place where the experimental work was being done with new night fighting apparatus, and that all had to come out of one's sleep time. So I was pretty well all in by the end of the battle.
Everyone I speak to, airmen, civilians, and men from the other services, all say that they were totally unaware that this was to be a make-or-break period, that it was so critical. Just how did you view those times?
Well, I think only by exercising my common sense, I probably knew what they didn't know at that time, that there was this large army just waiting to cross the channel, and knowing the condition and the number of troops that we were able to salvage from Dunkirk, knowing what very small chance we had of resisting any such attack, particularly as our troops had left all their heavy material behind in France.
Knowing this, and knowing just how unprepared we were and how completely defenseless we were, do you think it was at all necessary that the Battle of Britain had been fought from the German side if they hadn't waited that period of weeks after Dunkirk, if they had come in immediately after Dunkirk with paratroops?
Well, I don't know. It's much more difficult, of course, to make a parachute attack and keep it up and supply your troops with ammunition and that sort of thing which they require for their work. Much more difficult than to make a seaborne crossing, and having effected seaborne crossing and landing places on the east coast, it would have been easier, I think, to keep them supplied. But it wasn't as if I had any choice in the matter. They didn't attack immediately after Dunkirk, and they did make several other changes of policy with which I was thoroughly pleased. The month's respite that we got didn't only deal with the replacement of machines, which were coming out with great steadiness and regularity owing to the work of Lord Beaverbrook, but it helped over the pilots. The pilots were the crux of the matter with me at the time.
How important was this 1 month breathing space to the British?
Oh, well, there was rather sporadic in intermittent fighting. It hadn't settled down to such a steady, grim business as it did later on. But I didn't feel that we were having a respite at all. What I had been afraid of was that our squadrons would be given away to the French. Not that they would be annihilated by fighting with the Germans, you see. And so, from one point of view, I would agree that the Battle of Britain really began about the first week in July. But in my opinion, it really began long before. It began in the first half of May, because by the middle of May, I had already begun to get anxious about the losses which we had incurred, and that was when I asked for an interview with the War Cabinet and was able to explain to them the rather desperate nature of the situation if my squadrons were going to be sent off and off and off to France, because that was what had been happening. And I knew that Churchill was under tremendous pressure from the French, of course, to supply them with air reinforcements, but it went far beyond that, because what the French really wanted Churchill to do was to give them our whole fighter air force. In fact, I think the whole air force, and let them be commanded by their generals in France, which of course would have meant the end of the war like that, because the French were by then a beaten nation already. And so I felt that it was tremendously important to stop that drain on our fighter forces. Not that I would lose my machines in our fighting, but that I would lose them by being handed over to the French. And in effect, that request was granted.
You mentioned your request to see the War Cabinet.
Yes.
Wasn't it unusual for somebody in your position to even make the request?
Nobody was more surprised when I was given permission to state my case to the War Cabinet. I hadn't thought it was possible, but I thought it was worth trying. And when I went there, there was this long room in Downing Street with a table of 30 or 40 people sitting round it, and Churchill was sitting on one side and I was sitting on the other, nearly opposite him, and he asked me to state my case. And I got up, and with all the very limited eloquence at my command, I pleaded that we might be allowed to keep the fighters that we had. Churchill didn't answer at all. He just sat there with a fixed expression on his face, which never altered at all, and I could see that I wasn't getting anywhere. Well, I knew something about Churchill, and that was that he had a fondness for elementary mathematics, and that some people can be convinced through their eyes where they can't be convinced through their ears. So I had equipped myself with a diagram with a red line sloping down showing the expenditure of hurricane aircraft, and I walked all the way around the table up the other side till I got behind Churchill, and then I put this diagram down on the table, this graph, and I said, this is the state of affairs today, sir. This is the loss of hurricanes in the last 10 days. That brings us down to this point. If that loss continues at the same rate, there won't be a single hurricane left in France or in England. And that did the trick, you see. Again, he didn't say anything at all, but from everything that I could see, every sign that I could see, he had been convinced by that. But anyway, we were under orders to send 10 squadrons to France before that meeting, which still went. Never after that occasion did he order any fresh machines to be sent across to the French. And I was so afraid that he would change his mind, you see, that as soon as I got back, I wrote that letter to the Air Ministry, which has been framed by somebody.
Sir Max Aitken, Lord Beaverbrook's son, who was in command of a squadron at the time,
Yes. He's
told us that on the night of that War Cabinet meeting,
Yes. Lord
Beaverbrook rang him with what he thought was the good news, that you Yes. Had succeeded and that Yes. No more planes were being sent.
Yes.
But Sir Max Aitken suggests that during the night or early the next morning, there were counter orders from Churchill in Paris.
I believe that is true, that the pressure was renewed as soon as... You see, Churchill went over to Paris, must have gone over directly after that meeting, and the politicians in Paris had put such pressure on him that he counter-ordered his counter-order. And anyway, the important thing was that virtually and substantially the leakage of fighter aircraft to France was stopped.
After that meeting, what were Churchill's relations with you at other
times? I never was very friendly with Churchill, you see, because he had been made to change his very stubborn mind in front of a room full of senior officers and officials in the country. He didn't like that. I don't want to say anything against Churchill, but you ask me that question, and I don't think he ever liked me very much after that, even if he had liked me before.
You talk about how weak the strength of the fighter command was, but how had the strength of fighter command become so weak, far below the minimum that had been laid down?
Well, you must ask the Air Ministry. My establishment was 52 squadrons. My strength at the time when I asked for that meeting was 34. You're no good. If you ask me how did that happen, well, I simply say that I hadn't been kept up to strength. I never had nearly attained to the strength of 52 squadrons.
General Gallant has always said what a terrible fear and what a barrier the Channel was to the German Luftwaffe.
Yeah.
Why was it such a barrier to the Germans and not to us?
Well, you see, their main handicap was the short petrol endurance of their single-seater fighters, of the ME-109s, and I believe, and I've been told afterwards, that the shore of northern France after the Battle of Britain were littered with the wrecks of these machines that had just staggered as far as the sand and collapsed there, and many, many of them fell into the sea. And so, from that point of view, they were not equipped with the fighter that had an adequate minimum range for the attack on England.
I asked General Gallant why the Luftwaffe never really returned to the attack on the radar stations. And he gave me various reasons for it, but the one that stood out in my mind was that they just could not believe that the British would have built the detecting stations above ground, those little brick buildings next door to the Mars. He felt certain that the British would have built them deep underground, and they felt, well, they couldn't hit it. Does this sound typically what I would call British and mad?
It was typically British and mad, but we had to construct this very elaborate organization all around the country. And if we had put everything underground, it would have been done by now. That really was the thing. It was first things first with us for survival, as I saw it. And I quite agree that every one of these systems ought to have been buried deep underground, but it was an expensive and laborious business, and it took a long time.
Did the government grant you enough money to have spent the money on it?
Well, I don't know. I will never say that I was refused money to build underground operations rooms, but the fact was, I mean, you'll agree with that, it was first things first, wasn't it? But the reason why the Germans discontinued their attacks on the radar screen was that they didn't know how much damage they'd done. And I don't suppose Gallant, when he was talking to you, knew how much they damaged the system as a whole. There's one big, you know, the enormous great mast, Ventnor, Isle of Wight, they actually brought down, I believe. But that was the only one they did. And though they attacked many others, the fact that they were constructed of open lattice work meant that a lot of splinters went through without doing any harm. And even where the splinters did cut a girder, it was only a comparatively small one. And the astonishing thing was that so many of these funny little flat-topped roofs on the outskirts of the station escaped damage at all.
In fact, we couldn't have built our radar stations more plainly and more openly if we'd tried, and yet they still didn't know this, because Gallant admits that they just didn't know at that time how much he could do.
I don't suppose they even knew that they were radar stations. I don't suppose they knew what functions those big masts fulfilled if they saw them.
You have been given the credit, and correctly so, for seeing the great potential of radar in the very beginning, in the early stages. Did you encounter much opposition? Were people incredulous that this sort of thing would work?
I don't think so, because it was so very easy to convince a skeptic. I mean, you've got to just take him down to any operations room and have an aeroplane flying about in the air outside and say, well, there you are on the screen. I don't think I found any backwardness in that way, or in any way, I will say. I only mean that if you don't keep an eye on the course of events, things may go backwards, and very often do, in my experience.
Can I change the subject a little bit now? Do you think the cabinet, Churchill and the other political leaders, knew that Hitler had banned any bombing of London?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. It started with an accidental straying over London by one of Hitler's squadrons, and dropping some bombs in a comparatively unimportant part of London. And so then the Air Ministry said, hello, we can't have this, we'll bomb their capital now. And so they sent off a ludicrous raid of about 20 machines or something of that sort, and half of them lost their way on the way to Berlin, and they dropped a few puny bombs on Berlin. And then Hitler went completely up the wall. He went mad with rage, and he called off all the bombing of our aerodromes and concentrated it on London.
If I can split these two, if Churchill and the cabinet knew that Hitler had banned any bombing on London, surely they must have realized the consequences of their reprisal raid on Berlin.
Well, I wouldn't be prepared to take it for granted that Churchill and others did know that Hitler had banned the bombing of London. I think it's quite possible that that's a fact that might have only come out subsequently. But in any case, in answer to the second part of your question about my knowing about the orders under which a small bomber formation was sent out as a reprisal to bomb Berlin, I say no, I didn't know anything about it, and it isn't a thing that I would have known about. I had quite enough on my plate to worry about what orders the Air Ministry gave to the Bomber Command.
When Hitler made his famous speech at the Sportspalast on the, I think it was the 4th of September, and he threatened to obliterate the English cities, what precautionary measures were taken by Fighter Command to counteract this? Because it is said that Fighter Command were caught unawares.
No, by no means. It was always a possible line of attack which the Germans might have taken any time. But it was Fighter Command's duty to prevent attacks developing on London as far as was in their power. But that was an enormous task, and we couldn't have stopped the Germans bombing London except by a process of attrition which might have lasted months.
How did you assess the skill and prowess of the Luftwaffe as compared with the RAF?
I wouldn't like to make any differentiation at all between them and Fighter Command. I think that both in technical skill and in courage, we could claim no superiority over the Germans, and I don't think that any higher degree of skill and courage could possibly have been expected.
You have established before that you've never met Goering at all.
No.
But how did you assess him as a commander?
It was purely hearsay, you see. I had never seen Goering in my life. I did gather that it was Goering who was practically in sole charge of the German attack on this front, with the exception that it was subject to Hitler's consent. And an instance of that was that Hitler said to Goering, how long will it take you to crush the British Air Force? And Goering laughed and said, that contemptible little force, 3 days, sir, or give me 5 to make sure. And after that, he was continually asking for more and more extensions of time, getting them by weeks and fortnights and that sort of thing. And Hitler was getting more and more impatient. He'd got a whole army sitting in barges and launches and various boats in the canals along the coast of northern France and Belgium, and he didn't want to leave them there while Germany and Britain fought out a war across the sea in the air. And so Hitler gave Göring a final date of September the 15th. And he may or may not have, well, he certainly did exceed that, but he may or may not have been granted permission. But I don't know, these stories may not have been true. I hadn't got any evidence for them, but they all seem to fit in with the course of events.
If the victory had in the end gone the other way,
yeah,
being wise after the event, England would have been occupied. But
yeah,
could we have carried on the war from a distance, from Canada or Australia? How do you see
it? How could you carry on a war from Canada or Australia? Here would be the Germans. They were in the mother country. They were in control of all the communications and the factories and everything they wanted. I mean, I've heard this suggested several times. Oh, we should have gone over to Canada and continued the war from there. Well, it's just childish.
Do you think we could have put up any defense against an invasion?
Well, we should have put up some defense, but I'm quite sure it would have been quite ineffective.
Do you think that the very fact that we possessed Hurricanes and Spitfires, even though some people, including the Germans, say they were in many respects inferior to the Messerschmitt, you think that that was the most important factor in our winning the battle?
It's the only circumstance that made us capable of fighting it at all. I tell you this, you see, that if it hadn't been for the Schneider Cup trophy, there wouldn't have been any machines flying in the fighter command faster than the Gladiator biplane. And that, in fact, would have meant that we couldn't have fought the war at all, because the German bombers could fly away from any of those biplanes for themselves, leave alone any escort, you see. It's very important, I think, from the point of view of the war. In, what should we say, somewhere about 1930, we won the Schneider Trophy for the third time, and it became ours. We won it outright. And then the Air Ministry said, good, now come, we'll present another trophy and continue this international contest, rather like a Wimbledon tennis tournament, you see. And so I said, please not. We have spent some hundreds of thousands of pounds and 3 or 4 years in building the fastest seaplane in the world, and it is no good to us at all. What we want to do is, as a result of the Schneider Trophy, to put out specifications to our aircraft factories and say we'd like to see the design of the fastest aeroplane you can possibly build, with only one restriction, and that is in its landing speed. It must have a practical landing speed for landing on grassy, tufty airfields. And when one of the people at the Air Ministry said, well, we want to have something like this, only we want biplanes. Well, I said, did you order biplanes when you were competing for the Schneider Trophy? You ordered monoplanes, didn't you? I said, well, the same considerations hold here. And so they agreed to that, and they got in half a dozen drawings from the different firms, and we shells, those of the Hurricane and the Spitfire. They had no guns in them, they weren't military machines at all. They were simply built so as to be the fastest machines that they could possibly build with that single string tied to it, that it must have a restricted landing speed. I've forgotten what it was. It might have been 60 miles an hour, it might have been 70 miles an hour, I don't know. Well, these two machines were produced, and they were the Hurricane and the Spitfire. And then there were people who had the sense to put 8 guns into them and make them the most powerful fighter in the world. And that was done, but it was done very slowly. And they were only just coming into production at the beginning of the war. And if it hadn't been for those machines, I don't know what we should have done with it. Biplane is inherently slower than the monoplane. It may be stronger and lighter in some respects and so on, but you cannot get top speed out of a biplane.
Do you think the Messerschmitt, the 109, was a better plane?
Well, I don't think so. It was just better in top speed, or equal to the Spitfire in the top speed, and about 10 miles an hour faster than the Hurricane. The Messerschmitt was more maneuverable, just more maneuverable than either of our machines, because we had float carburetors and the Germans had injection ignition. I wouldn't claim absolute superiority for any of our types over the Germans. All I say is that they were just good enough.
September the 15th has been termed the crucial day, the significant day. Would you agree, or do you have any other particular day that you think was more important?
Well, I don't. From my observation as the target, that the intensity of the attack didn't fall off till the end of the month. As far as I was concerned, the date of the heaviest German attacks and the heaviest casualties was 29th of September, after which signs became apparent that they had altered their air policy to some extent, because they ceased sending bombers over as the bait to draw our aircraft into the air, and they started putting bombers into their fighters, so that we couldn't tell, just seeing some machines flying in the air, whether that was the formation that was carrying the bombs or whether it was a fighter formation.
The claims of German losses that we used to hear on the BBC, and that famous one, September the 16th, the Monday morning, were they deliberately made to mislead or exaggerate?
Certainly
or?
Not. I'd like to tell you about that. We had the greatest anxiety to report accurately, but it was quite impossible in a dogfight, you see. Perhaps 3 or 4 of our machines would have been firing at a German when it went down. Or somebody said, oh, that's the chap I was shooting at, you see. And so it is quite inevitable that there should be exaggerated claims. What I believe is that our claims were not nearly so exaggerated as the Germans' claims.
Did you honestly believe them yourselves, or did you take them with a pinch of salt?
No. I used to study them every day, and you couldn't ask me, do you study, do you believe that report, do you believe that report? Nobody. There wasn't a soul in the world who knew what the facts were, because in the confusion of a dogfight, many people shot at the same machine, and all of them claimed it when it came down.
Could I go on to personalities now? How do you rate Mayor Vice Marshal Park and his contribution to the battle?
Well, I rate him to this extent that I say, if it hadn't been for Park, we shouldn't be here today. I really mean that, because his group bore the burden and heat of the day of the fighting, and I was entirely in agreement with him about the big wing, the small wing formation. And as a matter of fact, it wasn't a Park special invention, but the thing was that Park, in the forefront of the battle, he didn't have time to assemble a monster wing to go chasing after the formations of bombers and fighters. I think that he was a magnificent group commander. I couldn't have thought of anybody that I'd rather have had in preference to Park.
If circumstances so forced you to live through that period again, being in the same position, the same command, would you have done anything differently?
Well, all I can say is that she would have been my uncle.